This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The three areas in the raising of children, we're not dealing in the areas that we're particularly good at or that are well discussed in secular literature. The three areas that we are going to focus on are the areas of discipline, the creating of a norm, and a love for learning. Starting with the area of discipline, the Medrash at the beginning of Parsha Shmos says the following. The Medrash is commenting on a verse in the book of Mishlei, in the book of Proverbs. And the Vilna Gaon said and advised his family that the only, almost not the only, but the finest Musar Sefer by far, the Sefer for self-development, the book, the guide for self-development and ennoblement of character that exceeds all others, is the book of Mishlei, King Solomon's book of Proverbs. And a sentence in it, in chapter 13, verse 24, is Chosech Shivtoi Soinei Venoi. One who spares his rod, this is where it comes from, despises his son. The Oyhavoi Shicharoi Musa. But one who loves him teaches him with Musa, teaches him with discipline. Says the Medrash, Benoag Shebo'elam, the norm is, Odom Shoemel Lechavere Poleni, Hiko Levincho, if somebody would come and report to you that so and so hit your son, Yeridi Moyad Lechayov, he goes down, he'll almost murder that person. Matam Loma Chesech Shivtoi Soine Benoi. And here we're told that by sparing the rod, by not disciplining the child, one despises the child. L'lamedecho, to teach us a principle. Shekol hamoinea benoi min hamardus soifbo l'tarbus ro v'soneo. Anybody who protects his child from the pain of discipline will bring his child to deterioration, and eventually he will despise his own child, says the Medrash. And the Medrash then gives several examples. Sheken matzino bi Yishmoel shehoyu loy gaaguim al Avrom Aviv. Yishmoel was very close to his father Avrom, and Avrom loved Yishmoel very much. For a long time Yishmoel was his only son, and then he was not his only son, but his oldest son, son from Hagar, and Avram had a deep affection for Hagar. So much so that even when God instructed him to expel Yishmael from the home of Avram, Avram found that very difficult and very, very painful, even though he knew it was right because God told him. Veloridohu, and he did not discipline Yishmael. The Medrash puts the blame for Yishmael's behavior on Avraham Avinu. Amazing accusation. Because think of what's come out of Yishmael. Everything that's happening now, plus everything that's happened in between then and now. And where is it from? From a little boy, thousands of years ago, who wasn't properly brought up. It's all very well when somebody makes an enormous contribution to the world, we say, isn't it wonderful? Look, one person, look what they can do to the world. Look what Einstein can do to the world. Look what Shakespeare has done to the world. Look what Mozart has done to the world. That's true, what one person can do to the world. But look what Hitler did to the world. And look what Yishmael did to the world. And look what Amalek did to the world. There are also sometimes individuals that destroy the world. And the Medrash, picking Yishmael as one of the examples, blames Avram for being too soft on Yishmael. The Medrash goes through the various things that Yishmael did. The second example was Esav. We're told that Yitzchok loved Esav, and Esav was the problem child. You know, they say you can't love a child enough, and they can't be enough. But it depends what you mean by love. Here we have examples in the early chapters of the Torah of a father who loved a child too much, loved Yishmael too much, loved Esav too much. And the third example was Avshalom. David HaMelech loved Avshalom too much. These were three cases of fathers who were besotted with their children, and the children didn't grow up in any way meriting that kind of love. What is that? Why do we say so often that you can never give a child enough love, and yet the Medrash is claiming that love can be a dangerous instrument in the hands of a father? The Tiferet Tzion says the reason is that when a father is soft on a child, what he's really doing is avoiding his own pain, not the child's pain. He doesn't want to experience the pain that the child will feel when he disciplines the child. Now, we'll still discuss how you discipline a child. We're not necessarily talking about corporal punishment, although the halachas favors it on many occasions for children of certain ages and certain types. But that's not the issue. The issue is that whatever discipline one uses, in order to be effective, will be painful. And usually the reason that a parent will not discipline the child, it is because the parent doesn't want to feel the pain, not because the parent loves the child and doesn't want the child to feel the pain. There's a difference in attitude. Because if the parent was really concerned about the child, the parent would be thinking strategically forward into the child's life and would be saying the learning lessons for the child are some of the most important things I as a parent can do for my child, to provide my child with learning lessons. And the most important learning lesson is that there is consequence. There's consequence for bad behavior, just as there's good consequence for good behavior. And one of the most damaging lessons that we can teach a child is the lack of consequence. That you can be rude and discourteous and get away with it. That you can be dishonest and deceitful and get away with it. That you can be arrogant and you can get away with it. That there will not be consequence. That's one of the biggest disservices you can possibly give a child. What are you giving him in that sense? You're giving him a value system. And the value system is arrogance, discourtesy, abusiveness. That's the value system you're giving. That's your gift to the child. So a parent who loves a child surely will want more than anything else to give the child a value system. And the only way you can give a child a value system is to teach the child the consequence of the actions that he performs. Not just to teach him intellectually that he should or shouldn't do certain things. What are the things that you discipline a child for? The Vilna Gaon points out that you don't punish the child for the big things. Shedoresh olov. The art is to seek, to examine closely. Pen oso nidnut kal, in case the child did something very minor. Umeyaser olov alze, and discipline him on the minor thing. For two reasons. Firstly, then the discipline doesn't have to be that heavy. You can get the message across with a much lighter enforcement. And secondly, the message to the child is all the greater. Even something as small as this, my father doesn't approve of. Even something that looks so irrelevant, my father doesn't approve of. And that can lead into a discussion as to why not. But then there's the natural Kal Vachomer system. Then the child understands, and certainly anything more serious. But by only kicking your discipline in at a certain point, you're actually okaying everything below that level. And what kind of discipline is that? Why would you want to okay anything below that level? This is your child. This is not a society that you're trying to keep civil. This is your child that you're trying to educate. This is your child that you're trying to raise. This is your child to whom you're trying to bestow a value system. And the bestowing of the value system means pick on the small little things and let the child experience the unacceptability of those small things and why they're unacceptable. And the Vilna Gaon quotes the Baal HaKedah and says it's like a woman who's busy doing her makeup before she goes out. And she uses a mirror that magnifies her face. Why? She wants blemishes to be magnified. Because in the process of preparation for going out, she wants to see every tiny little blemish that maybe has to be taken care of. when she's out, then she wants to sit in dim lights and she doesn't want anybody to look too closely, and it looks much more romantic that way. But when she's preparing herself, she wants to be very, very meticulous. And education and raising children is the preparation process. That's the doing out, that's the getting the makeup on. That's preparing the child to go out into life. In that interaction, the magnifying glass is on. In that interaction, full lights are on. In that interaction, the child has to understand that what he's experiencing is not just the fun of being a child. The childhood is, sure, there's a fun part of it, but and that's very important, the fun part of it. But childhood is also a process of learning and growing and acquiring a value system with which he'll be able to enter the world effectively at a later stage. The Vilna Gaon also says elsewhere, very important to discipline the child not when you're angry. When you're angry, it's either too early or too late. Because then you're not disciplining the child, you're abusing the child. And you're venting your anger on the child. That's not education. Education is not that the child should think that the reason that you're hitting him is because you're angry. There's only one reason you're hitting him or talking to him or scolding him or taking away one of his privileges or whatever you want to do as part of that punishment. There's only one reason, and that is what you did isn't right, and you shouldn't do it again. That's all that it is. There should never be a sense of anger and venting in the way a parent disciplines a child. And it's for that reason that the prime disciplinarian should preferably be the father. The father is supposed to be more capable of allowing the anger not to influence, to be a little bit more level-headed about that. Sometimes the mother responds in a very emotive way. She feels very, very close to the child. And the child can get at the mother more easily than the child can get at the father. And children know how to do that. They know how to get their parents angry. And particularly mothers. And when the child is successful at getting the mother angry, and the mother strikes out at the child in anger, that's a victory for the child. That's a total victory. That's just one more weakness that he's exposed in the parent, in the authority figure. And therefore the most important thing is for the parent to be able to act preferably before there's anger, and then you never get into the irritation stage. Or if there is already anger, to wait for that anger to subside and then to bring the discipline into play. It doesn't matter if it's quite a while after the activity. The children remember. And how do you discipline? One of the most important psukim in the book of Mishlei, and in fact in the whole Torah, as far as education is concerned, is a verse in chapter 22 of Mishlei. Chanoich lanar al pi darko. If you educate a child according to his own way, gam ki yazkin lo yosu mimeno, then it'll last his entire life. Even in his old age, he will remember it. Different children need different disciplines. There are children who just need a stern look from a parent, and that causes them such pain and anguish. They're so sensitive that they immediately stop what they're doing, and they never want to do it again. They never want to see that expression on their parent's face again. And some children would laugh at that. Some children need to be disciplined more severely. Some children, discipline is taking away a freedom or a privilege. Some children do need a good hiding. Sometimes children do need to feel some level of pain. Again, terribly important though that if one does that it's not an act of abuse, that it's done in a way that is loving, in a way that attempts to minimize the pain, because when a child is hit by a parent, it's the humiliation which is educating more than the pain. And very often it's not necessary, and with many children it isn't necessary at all. And with those children that it is necessary, it shouldn't be necessary more than once or twice in the child's lifetime. If you need to hit a child more than once or twice, then hitting is the wrong punishment, or you're doing it wrong. It shouldn't be necessary to strike out at a child more than once or twice. Occasionally when my kids get into reminiscing mode, they compare notes about the one time they all go to hiding. And each of them just happened once, and they were for minor things, but the impression was indelible. The impression was amazing, because the issue was disobedience, the issue was destructiveness, the issue was doing something they knew at the time was wrong, and it's something that remained with them, was never necessary again and shouldn't be necessary again if it's effective. If it isn't effective, then one has to find some other form of discipline, because some children just don't respond to being hit, and some children don't need it. To hit a child who doesn't need to be hit is an act of violent abuse. To hit a child who is sensitive, who could do with a look or with a harsh word, is an act of violating the sanctity of that child's life merely to vent the parent's anger. Very important. Chanoich l'nar al pi darko. Understand the child, understand what works for the child, understand what hurts the child, but make sure that whatever you do hurts. If it doesn't hurt, it's not discipline. What is the role of the mother? The role of the mother is comforting, because in discipline there is a gvuro and there's a chesed, there is a toughness and there is a kindness, and the same person can't do both. It's very confusing to the child if the father gives the child a hiding and then straight away says, don't worry, it's not so serious and it's really okay. And what is the child supposed to think? But the mother can comfort the child. The mother can say, you need to understand why you did it, and I'm sure you'll never do it again, and I'm sure you didn't intend to do it, and you'll go and you'll apologize to your father and everything will be alright. There is an in-syncness between a mother and a father that creates a message that is mutually supportive. Although they're conflicting, they're opposite, they're mutually supportive and in no way cause a negative tension in the child's understanding of the message that the parent is giving. What's important to understand about discipline is that in the younger years, and we'll talk about in a moment why that's such an important time, and older, the philosophy a child will develop, or an adult for that matter, will be a philosophy that explains his actions. We like to think that we find a philosophy and then we act accordingly. That sometimes happens. But usually we act and develop philosophies to explain why we do the things we do. And sometimes they're valid explanations and sometimes they're poor attempts at justification. And so to teach a child the theory, to take years and years to teach the child the theory of morality and good values and religion and belief in God, and expect the child to slowly, as he's growing, or she's growing, start modifying their life to fit in with the philosophy one's teaching, that's unlikely. What's more likely to, and if it does happen, it's usually superficial, it's usually artificial. The child doesn't naturally grow that way, so now there's this philosophy and the child starts modifying his or her actions to fit in with the philosophy, and there's a disconnect between the actions and the philosophy. It's much more likely that the child's behavior is molded, and the child will develop his own philosophy to explain why he does the things he does and why he doesn't do the things he doesn't do. Now, very interesting in a child's mind is up to a certain age, and sometimes even older, a child doesn't need a whole lot of philosophy to understand that there are certain things that aren't okay. A child has an intuitive understanding of what's right and what's wrong. The child just has to have the imposition of the rules and the understanding of the consequence in doing what's wrong. So very often, when a child asks, why aren't I allowed to do this? And particularly, as I mentioned in another shiur recently, when a child says, but everybody does it. That's our big problem in society today, where the children are being exposed to children from all sorts of different backgrounds and even in a Jewish environment, we're talking about that. Children with all different sorts of value systems. There used to be a time in a little shtetl where your kids used to play with kids like them. Now your kids don't play with kids like them at all. I remember I was in Rav Meir Soloveitchik's home, and he looked out of the window and he saw his child walk across the street and enter into conversation with another child. And he called his child and he said, who is that child you were talking to? And his child said, I don't really know, a kid in the neighborhood. The man said, how can you be engaging in relationships with somebody you don't know? Find out who he is. Where does he come from? What are his parents? What are they? You can't just enter into any old relationship. No, that's quite extreme. But that's how they're raised, in terms of an understanding that on the streets where they live, there are all sorts of types of people. And there's an expectation that the child will build relationships with children like himself from a similar value system at that particular age. Today, in our kind of environment, that's virtually impossible. However, to engage in a long debate with the child about why they do it and we don't do it and they can and we can't, a child is very receptive to a very simple answer. You're right, everybody does it. Our family doesn't. And the child builds a sense of belonging to a family unit. And very seldom will the child ask, why not? Very seldom. Because there's a kind of pride in the child too. Wow, our family doesn't, we're different. There's a sense of specialness. There's a sense of separateness. And we discussed in a recent shiur on Shabbat afternoon that kedusha, that sanctity, comes from some degree of separateness. And separateness doesn't mean, as we described on Shabbat, that other people see that you are separate. If somebody else views you as separate, you're failing. Separateness is, they think I'm one of them. I know I'm different. That's separateness. That's nobility. And today we work in exactly the opposite way. We develop separateness through external manifestation, and the internal is just the same. There is no difference. No. Separateness, when we talk about kedusha, we're talking about a person feeling separate, not acting separate. There's a very big difference between the two. But to be able to say to a child, our family doesn't do this, and if that's observed consistently, it doesn't work if sometimes the family doesn't, sometimes the family doesn't, and some children are allowed to, and some children are not allowed to, that won't work. But when the child starts hearing, our family doesn't, that creates a sense of bonding. We're fortunate to come from a family, a very large family, extended family, second cousins, third cousins. And my children, as they're traveling, are beginning for the first time to meet cousins, that second and third cousins that they didn't know existed even, never mind that they hadn't heard of. They sometimes just bump into them. They meet them at a simcha, or they bump into them at a school. And there's suddenly a realization that a lot of the things they were never allowed to do, nor were any of their cousins who've had no contact with them, nor have their parents had much contact, because that's what a family was. That there are just certain things, certain values that that particular family stood for. Sometimes it deteriorates as the years go by, some of them are preserved, but when a child is able to recognize a cousin by a value system, that's very meaningful and very special. When a child can feel that sense of immediate comfort and connectedness, because they share almost, their growing up experiences were similar, although they were in different parts of the world, doing completely different things. But there was a similarity of a value system that they learned in the process. That's enormously valuable to a child. And so one doesn't always have to have a reason why it's right to do good and it's wrong to do bad. They don't always have a reason. If somebody pulls a Sefer Torah out of the Ark in Shul and starts standing on it and stamping on it, and you come up to him and say, don't do that, it wouldn't be appropriate for him to say, why not? Explain the reason to me. There are some things you know we just don't do. Some things are obvious to everybody, some things are obvious to particular families, and some things only become obvious to children when it's constantly pointed out. And in pointing out what we don't do, it's equally important to point out what we do do. We don't do that, we do this. So it's not just an issue of negatives being piled up one on top of the other. This is how we do it. This is how we go about that thing. That which everybody else does, we do in a different way. We get that benefit in a different way. We go about it in a different way. And that leads us into the second issue, which is the creation of the norm. You'll often hear people saying, I want my children to choose their religious direction. I'm not going to impose it on them. I'll give them a neutral kind of thing. I'll go to a Jewish school or whatever it is, but no heavy direction from me. I want to leave it to them. That seldom works. Occasionally it works, depending on the kind of family environment that is structured, but it seldom works. Because at the end of the day, a person grows up thinking certain things are normal and certain things are abnormal. You know that anybody whose religious or political views are to the left of you is a liberal, and anybody who's on the right of you is a dogmatic fanatic. Doesn't matter where you are. Where you are is normal. And we grow up with a sense of what's normal. We grow up with a starting point of what's normal. And a parent cannot get away from that. A parent cannot say, I'm going to let my child make his own choices. The child will not be making his own choices of what is normal. The child will only make his own choices to deviate from the norm. A child might say, I grew up where this was the norm, and I'm choosing to move away from that norm and to adopt a different value system or lifestyle. But you cannot raise the child without that norm. Whatever you're going to do, the child is going to have the norm. And so the process of education, in a sense, starts very, very young. The Gemara says, how old does a child have to be obligated to sit in the sukkah? You know, we celebrate bar mitzvahs, because bar mitzvah time, a child's obligated to keep the mitzvah. From what age does a child have to celebrate, has to sit in the sukkah? The Gemara says, Koton she'eno tzorich le'imoy chayev b'sukkah. If he's old enough to run around without his mother, he's old enough to sit in the sukkah. That's when you start seating a child in a sukkah. You don't say, you know, he's only a child, we'll make a small sukkah, and it doesn't matter if he's not in the sukkah, he's not bar mitzvah yet. That messes up the norm. Now you're turning religion into a ritual by saying, the day you turn 13, that's when you sit in the sukkah. That's not a norm. If it's a norm, you sit in the sukkah from childhood. To make it feel normal, it's long before bar mitzvah. Bar mitzvah is nothing. And part of the reason that bar mitzvah has become so overstated in our society is because it's not normal. Because religion is not normal with us. We don't create the norm. If we created the norm, there's nothing that would change as the child becomes bar mitzvah, except he's putting on tefillin. Fasting he starts a little bit before, but there would be nothing there. Even tefillin he started 3 months before bar mitzvah. There should be nothing that the child starts at his bar mitzvah that he wasn't doing before, other than leading the community. He can daven as the chazan, he can say the kriya satora, he can be moitzi other people, he can do mitzvahs on behalf of other people. That's the only change. But in every other sense, he's been doing the mitzvahs for years already. What about a lulav? Koton sheyesh boi da'as l'na'anea lulav. Child who is intelligent enough to move a lulav. It's quite young, that, you know. Most parents think their children are intelligent at quite an early age. Well then, aviv lokeach lo lulav, then his father has to buy him a lulav. How often do you see that? That's the age at which a child starts using a lulav. From the time that the father starts saying, isn't he clever? Clever! Get him a lulav, if he's so clever. And if he's not clever enough to hold a lulav, don't call him clever. That's about one of the simplest things you have to do as a Jew. If you can hold a lulav, you're clever. And if you can, get a lulav. Because if you don't, if you wait till bar mitzvah, the lulav's never normal. The lulav's a ritual. No, wait, but from my bar mitzvah, I've got to start wearing. No, that's not what it is. Make it normal. Make it something you do sukkah time. Everybody does it. I've been doing it all my life. That's what you want. You want the child to feel that it is so integrated that it's part of him and natural for him. Hayodel his atef, a child who knows how to put on clothes. Chayiv b'tzitzis, where's tzitzis? And wait till later on. It's hard for a child to get used to wearing tzitzis. It's restrictive. It sometimes irritates him a little bit. And the older it is, the harder it is. You start early, it's totally normal, like any other item of clothing. If you started putting any clothing onto a child, if you let a child run around without clothing until the child was 6 or 7, the child would find clothing irritating and restrictive and wouldn't want to wear the clothes. The reason people are comfortable in clothes is because they start quite young. And so it is with tzitzis. Of course a child finds tzitzis restrictive, unless he grew up with it. And growing up with it means from very early childhood. That's how we initiate the children into the mitzvahs, so that the mitzvahs are normal. The Yiddishkeit is normal. Now you want to leave the normality, that's your choice. And that we can leave to the child. We've educated the child, we've taught the child, we've provided the norm, we've created a normal environment, we've given the child a value system. What more can you do? You can't govern the child, you can't control the child. There comes a time and there comes a point where the children will make their own decisions. Yishmael did, and Esav did, and Avshalom did, and so many others did. And so be it. That's their decision, that's their choice. But you've got to create the norm. It's got to be normal for the child. Otherwise, you're not giving the child a fair chance. To say to a 13-year-old, you know what? You've never worn tzitzis before, but if you want to start wearing tzitzis, try it out. The child puts it on, says it's uncomfortable. What chances have you got of the child being willing to wear the tzitzis? And so it is with all the mitzvahs. Keeping Shabbos is abnormal. Keeping kashrus is abnormal. All these things are abnormal if you haven't done it since childhood. And then they become artificial, and then they become superficial, and then they become ridiculous sometimes, because they're never fully integrated. And it's one of the biggest challenges of a person who becomes religious later on in his life, to create normality out of his religion, to be able to function religiously as a normal human being. Very hard to do, very difficult, because what is lacking is what we call the girsa de yankusa, the learning of being a baby, the learning that you do when you're a baby can never be made up in a kind of a way. That's something that one misses, and one has to try and create normality even though one might not have had that. It's interesting that that's firstly how the Menorah Samor learns that very same pasuk. Chanoich lenar al pi darko. We learned it initially, the normal way it's read and translated, is educate a child according to his own style, according to his own personality. Don't try and force children into molds that don't fit them. Each child has a character and a personality. Get to know that personality early on so that you can guide the child in a route that will take him using his personality. Each child in the family should function and operate completely differently. It's very often you'll find all the children in a family go to the same school, even though there's sometimes a large variety of schools in a neighborhood or in a city. And that's always a bit of a problem to me when all the children go to the same school. That's usually either because the parent only wants to carpool once, which means it gives one an idea of what the education is about in their minds, or because there isn't enough differentiation to understand that for some children this approach is better, for some children that approach is better, and in the same family it's important to differentiate. Just as you differentiate styles and fashion and hobbies and friends, so you differentiate educational style to find for each child that which sits comfortably, naturally and normally with that particular child. And we say every morning two things we ask God for when it comes to the learning of Torah. The Ha'aravno, may the Torah be pleasant to us, because if it's not pleasant, it's also artificial. And the Targileinu b'seirosecho, make it hergel, make it normal for us, make it something that we do. I don't want to use the word routine, because that implies mindlessly. The sense here is not mindless, the sense is just, it's normal. It's hergel, it's something we walk with. And that, says the Menorah Samor, is the meaning of Chanoich Lenar Al Pi Darko. Educate the child as he walks. Al Pi Darko, from Derech. Let it be his normal way of being. Create a normality for the child, not an artificiality for the child. So we have discipline, and we have the norm. In discipline, by the way, one of the things I didn't touch on, and that's really important, is and leads into the next issue, is the discipline of learning, the discipline of reading, and the discipline of listening. An amazingly important gift to give a child, and very, very serious deprivation to deny a child. And that's one of the areas that we fail in. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind, and I'm sure in the minds of many specialists, not all of them, that ADD is a function of our society. It's got nothing to do with chemicals. Surely there are chemical imbalances, but as we've often discussed, nobody's proved whether the chemical imbalance causes the ADD or the ADD causes the chemical imbalance. Which comes first? Does the behavior cause a change in chemical, or does the chemical cause the change in action? There are some for whom it's obviously something biological and anatomical and physiological and needs to be treated medically. But with many others, it's a function of the way children are brought up from early childhood, little babies. And you see them awake late at night with the tumult going on, and when the parents go visiting, the babies go with, and when they should be sleeping, they're awake. And there's a tumult going on around them, and sometimes it's within the family and sometimes it's outside. Sometimes there's a television blaring when the baby's trying to sleep or to play, and there's a television going, and the baby's watching the television. And although the baby doesn't understand anything, watch the baby's eyes and see how the quick time frame, the quick changes on the screen are affecting the baby's eyes all the time. That's building in the ADD. That's building in the incapacity of the child to focus and to concentrate and to sit through something. The importance of having a child sit through a shiur, even if the child doesn't understand a word. It doesn't do any harm to have a child who's of the right age. So you have to just sit still and listen. The rabbi's talking in shiur, sit still and listen. It doesn't matter if you don't understand a word. Learn how to sit even when you don't understand. because then you will learn to understand. If you only listen, if you only sit still when you understand, then you will only learn things that are easy. The only time you'll learn something that is challenging is if you're willing to sit through something and not understand it necessarily, or take a while before one is able to understand it. I met a very special old man who used to live in Los Angeles. He was an accountant, but he was a very big Talmid Chacham. And then he went to live with his children in Monsey, where he still lives. And he lived with he learned with Rebbe Baruch Baer. And I said to him, very interesting, he learned with Rebbe Baruch Baer. I said to him, you know, Rebbe Baruch Baer, I've tried to understand Rebbe Baruch Baer's shiurim. I've struggled over them. I've broken my head over them. And I very seldom have been able to get any inkling about what he's talking. So he laughed. He said, yes, me too. I said, phew, well, that's a relief. I said, well, what was it like? I said, so why did you learn? Why did you go to Rebbe Baruch Baer? He said, for the shiurim. The only reason I was at that yeshiva was to listen to Rebbe Baruch Baer's lessons. I said, well, when he spoke, was it easier? Could you understand when he spoke? He said, no, you couldn't understand. It was just too difficult and too deep. So I said, so then what do you mean that you were there for the shiur? He said, because you could see the way he thought. You couldn't understand what he was. It was worth it just to see the way he thought. So they used to sit there for an hour and a half, 2 hours, listening to a shiur they couldn't understand. My Rosh Hashiva in Kfar Chassidim, very, very few could understand his shiur. But everybody listened. Everybody sat for the hour and a half. Everybody, some understood the first 5 minutes, some understood the first 7 minutes, some the first 10, some developed further and further. I brought in a major innovation there, which was called a tape recorder, and you could tape the shiur and go over it and over it and over it and over it until one was able to grasp it. Teach the child to be willing to sit until they get it. And that can take a long time sometimes. The child doesn't have to jump up the moment he loses patience. That's discipline. You sit where you are, you wait till it's finished, and then you move. The last thing is the love of learning. And there's a very beautiful Gemara, which gives some kind of sense of what we try and inculcate into ourselves, never mind into our children. It says in the Torah, If one teaches one's grandchildren Torah, it's as if you got the Torah from Sinai. You know what it goes on developing that and says, why? Because it says, you shall teach the Torah to your children and your children's children. But immediately afterwards it says, and that is the day you stood before God on Sinai. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, Ashkechel Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba once met Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. The Shadi Disno Aresha. He was wearing a kind of a sheet on his head. Not his normal headgear. The Komantile Yenuke Lubei Knishten. He was carrying a child to shul. Amale Maikuli Hai. So he said to him, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, you must have left home in such a rush you couldn't find your hat. So you just put something on your head and you ran. Where are you going? Why such a hurry? It says when you take your child to learn with your child, it was like standing at Sinai. What do you do? If you heard the Torah was coming at Sinai, would you go looking for your hat? Or would you run out to receive the Torah? There's no time to look for my hat. I'm taking my child for learning in the morning. Imagine what that does to the child. From then onwards, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba loitoim umtza ad mikri liyunuki umusve. From then onwards, Rabbi Chiya bar Abba never had a bite of breakfast until he learned one sentence with his child, until he reviewed what the child had learned yesterday and learned an additional sentence. And again, imagine what it does to the child when the father says, I don't want breakfast until we've learned something. Then we'll have our breakfast. Let's learn something first. That's so much more valuable than you must learn and you must learn and you must learn. All you have to do is put it before breakfast. That gives much more message than all the fingers waving and all the stern words, just by putting it in the right place. And various other stories such as that, where we create in the child a sense of understanding of the urgency and the importance of the learning of Torah. Nevertheless, says the Rambam, if the choice is either you or your child can learn Torah, but not both, you don't have the funds or the time to be able to teach your child and study yourself, you come first. Teaching children is not the highest value. Being learned is the highest value. teaching children is an obligation. In order to be learned, you want to give your child a fair start. But to be learned is more important than to have learned children. Unless, says the Rambam, if the child shows specific talent and a great gift, more so than the father, then you might decide to invest in the child instead. But otherwise, it's the parent's obligation to become learned. And nothing will teach the child the value of learning more than seeing the parent learning, seeing the parent thinking, seeing the parent wanting to understand new ideas and new concepts, wanting to apply new thinking to the way he perceives the world and understands the world, being able to discuss those things with him. That creates an enormous sense of the value of learning. And so if we're able to take these three lessons with us, that is, the importance of discipline, the understanding that discipline is an act of love, not disciplining is an act of fear. We're sometimes scared to discipline because we're scared of the effect it has on ourselves. But if we truly love the child, we will discipline the child gently, kindly, softly. But there will always be some degree of discomfort and pain for the child, because that's what discipline means. And as the child improves and grows, it becomes less and less necessary. And occasionally you get a child who doesn't need it at all. And the importance of creating a norm from which the child bases himself and makes his choices, so that his religious practice, his value system, his moral choices are norms. This is the way we do things in our house. We've always done them this way. These are the choices we make. This is what's important to us. My father was like, my mother was like that, my uncles and aunts were like that, my grandparents were like that, and I'm like that. That's the way we were. Now, I might want to move off from that. That's my choice, but at least I know what the norms are. And it's not artificial, it's normal, it's real, it's integrated. And the third point, the love of learning. That if a child has discipline, a sense of normality, and a love of learning, the child is independent, the child can steer himself in any direction he wants. Without discipline, his learning will get him nowhere. Without a sense of normality, his learning will get him nowhere. Without learning, the discipline will not get him terribly far. In all areas, there's a need to self-improve using learning and discipline in an environment that is stable, that is normal, and that is attractive. Next week we'll move on to not how to raise children, but how to elevate parents.